every smartphone telling you basically that it should not be kept in the pocket. What kind of phone do you use?
A Nokia, and it's usually off when I have it in my pocket. I don't think it's called a smartphone. I think it's called a museum piece, but it serves my my purposes. And disconnect implies a number of things. It's a broad title because there's more than just the physiological health impacts that this technology has brought to bear on this society. Although we're talking about electromagnetic radiation, but it a kind of disease, kind of addiction. I see.
Well, that's interesting that you use those terms. I think a number of people are starting to reflect on the ways that digital devices have taken over people's private lives, and there's no more boundaries. People don't have a right to turn off and just be quiet and have be non-interrupted. And I think that there is a growing interest in trying to reclaim that. There are people like Tiffany Schlain who are talking about the need for a digital Sabbath. And families that are having rules, which I think are quite welcome, that all people have to deposit their devices before coming to the dinner table, and a growing number of teachers at all levels who are requiring that devices be turned off during their lectures, except for those that are being used, presumably as part of the class. And there's actually been some fascinating research recently conducted at Harvard Business School, finding that those who take notes with handwriting actually retain information at a much higher level than those who take notes on a screen.
Sure, there's a direct connection between the hand and the brain. So just like there's a direct connection between visual inputs and the brain in unexpected ways that affect how people process information as well as how people process the natural world around them. Can you sort of leads me astray into the issue of the way digital devices have led to the expansion of an industry called sleep medicine that seeks to remedy the problems people are having resting their brains, which is the function of sleep, cleaning out their
Well, actually, you've just raised a number of really fascinating topics, if I may interject for a moment.
Sure.
You're right that the hand and the brain and the eye are critically related, and in fact, there's a growing recognition by neuropsychiatrists that the learning of cursive writing involves connecting the eye, the brain, and the hand with little children's brains in a way that promotes the acquisition of empathy. And that moving to touching and swiping on screens without learning how to hold a crayon in their stubby fingers and learning how to make letters and make, more importantly, cursive writing, which millions of children around the world are no longer learning, that learning actually teaches children to acquire the ability to think about the other. And that there is a relationship between learning handwriting and being able to be empathetic. That's one issue. And with respect to sleep disturbances, you're absolutely on point. There's a growing recognition that the light from these devices, which has a predominant blue frequency, which is 440 nanometers, that blue light actually interferes with the production of melatonin. Now, melatonin is what the body makes at night when we sleep in the dark without all of these devices. If we sleep with our phone, if we're on our tablet right over our bodies just before going to bed, if we spend hours looking with our faces close to a screen, particularly in the dark, then the brain gets the signal that it should still be awake, and it doesn't make the amount of melatonin that we need normally to go into sleep and to go into the deep, restful sleep that the body and the brain needs in order to restore. Melatonin is a naturally produced material that repairs damage. It's an antioxidant. It affects almost every cell in the body. And we know that it can be very valuable for cancer patients, but for all of us, we need to produce natural levels of melatonin in order to have a deep, restful sleep. And people who just check for the last minute before they go to bed and check, you know, first thing, you indicated earlier in your remarks that these devices have become addictive, and they have. People have a right to get up in the morning and stretch, and a right to go to sleep at night taking deep breaths and relaxing, praying, meditating, whatever they might do to relax themselves. And if instead they just check that last email or send something off, or even worse, wake up in the middle of the night to do something that they've forgotten, it really gets the brain and the body confused, because it interferes with the cycle of melatonin, which we naturally need to restore the body.
You can find the melatonin for sale in supplement stores. I would suspect that popping a tablet doesn't restore the loss created by the effect you've just described. Do you concur with that, or have any
background? I think that's a good question, and like so much of this issue, we need research on a lot of questions. And the absence of definitive information on, for example, the link between cell phones and brain cancer is not proof of safety. I have my colleagues from the World Health Organization, we believe that the evidence linking cell phones and malignant brain cancer is very solid. And in 2011, the World Health Organization brought together a group of the world's experts on the issue of cell phone radiation and brain cancer. And they reviewed all of the evidence available as of 2011. And based on that review, they concluded that at that time in 2011, there was evidence that cell phone radiation was a, quote, possible human carcinogen, close quote. Now, in 2014, more research had appeared by that time. Most notably, the research from Leonard Hardell of Sweden, who is a prolific and distinguished epidemiologist and physician from Örebro, Sweden. In addition, a French national study appeared called Serenat by Corot and others from one of the national organizations in France looking at brain cancer data. They concluded that when you did a case control study where you compared people with brain cancer to those who did not have the disease, and you looked at those who had 10 or more years of using cell phones regularly for 30 minutes a day or more.
Is that continuous or collective?
It was over a period of 10 years.
No, but 30 minutes a day in a single call or...
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer, but I suspect it was not in a single call. No, I suspect it was cumulative. And now today, by the way, the average person is using their phone for close to 200 minutes a day. However, people are not holding the phone next to their brain as much, which is good, but we can get to that in a moment. The Consumer Reports has recommended that nobody should keep a phone in the pocket, and we can talk about why in just a second. But just to finish the brain cancer story, if I may, what they concluded in the French national study was that the heaviest users of cell phones had a significant increased risk, depending on how much longer they'd used it, at least tripled the risk. Now, what Hardell found is that those who began to use cell phones regularly as teenagers had 4 to 8 times more brain cancer 10 years later. Now, that's a huge risk, and that's a case control study. Now, often they'll say, well, wait a minute, there's no increase in brain cancer in the general population. As someone who's been studying brain cancer epidemiology for more than 30 years, I can tell you that that's exactly what we would expect. That is to say, there will be no increase in the general population of brain cancer associated with cell phones for maybe another 10 years. But we're already seeing signs of an increase in the youngest age groups, that is people 20 to 29 and 30 to 39. And when we look at that group as opposed to the whole population, ages 0 to 100, we are starting to see that that specific age group is showing an increase in glioma, which is a malignant and usually terminal cancer of the brain.
What percentage of increase?
Well, that's a good question. It looks like the annual increase is between 2 to 4% a year. And that sounds like a small number, but over a period of 20 years, it's almost a doubling.
Is that a 2% of the general population or the population of...
It's the general population of the age group 20 to 29 and 30 to 39.
What about the population of children who've been early adapters mimicking their parents and facilitated by their parents and peers?
Well, according to the largest study ever completed of brain cancer in the U.S. population, recently published by the Central Brain Tumor Registry of the United States, which does cover almost the entire United States, there is a significant increase in brain cancer in children also, defined as age 0 to 19. But that increase starts in the 1990s. Now, we did not start to use cell phones heavily as a population until 10 years ago or about, maybe a little more than 10 years ago. So this is the first generation of children with heavy cell phone use is just starting to reach the age when we're, unfortunately, there may be a reflection of the brain cancer increase from cell phones. However, this generation of children is also the generation that has had heavy use of computerized tomographic scans, CAT scans, for accidents. And what happens with the CAT scan is it can involve a massive amount of ionizing radiation, X-rays, as many as, depending on how the CAT scan is given, whether the machine is calibrated for the smaller head and size of a child, the CAT scan can result in between 2,000 to 4,000 chest X-rays for a single CAT scan. So when you're looking at the overall pattern of brain cancers, we know that ionizing radiation, like X-rays, clearly increases the risk of brain cancer. We know that from studies in Israel, led by Sigal Sadetsky and others of the survivors of the tinea capita cohort. These were children that were treated for ringworm with X-rays to the scalp. And they actually do have an increased risk of brain cancer from the X-ray. Cell phone radiation is non-ionizing. It's too weak to directly damage DNA. But we know that it does damage DNA through other means. And that research has been done mostly in other countries over a period of years. And that research clearly does show an increased risk. Most recently, the Cefalo study was published, and it did find something that scientists can't completely understand, which is that there is an increase in children's brain cancer with using cell phones for 3 to 4 years. And it's hard to explain how you would get an increase in such a short period of time, but certainly, again,
it's not so hard if you step back from the reductionist approach and look at the total assaults that technology has provided, or industrialization of technologies and consumer lifestyle have created, in which children, all of us swim, but children most certainly. You were cited in Rachel's Hazardous Waste Weekly for your research into brain cancer, and it was more toxins absorbed through in utero exposure or as infants to substances in food that weaken the repair mechanisms, that weaken the body's various defenses so that cancer becomes an issue. Although I'm not a medical specialist, so I don't know how rare.
Well, actually, I'm quite impressed with what you've just said. You're absolutely right. My earlier research was on what environmental factors could account for what was then an unexplained increase in brain cancer, and I published those results in The Lancet, frankly, more than 20 years ago.
That's right.
But what's really interesting about that issue, and I'm glad you raise it, I'm really impressed with your reading, frankly, is the following. What we know from experimental studies is that cell phone radiation weakens membranes. It weakens something called the blood-brain barrier. Now, I tell the story in my book, Disconnect, of how the first researcher came across this idea. They were doing research on what we now call cell phone radiation, before cell phones ever existed, because the radiation that we use for cell phones actually is a type of radar. That is to say, it's in that same frequency. Now, it's not nearly as powerful. Radar is much more powerful, but the frequency, it can be similar. The difference in power is important, though, because a microwave oven can cook a cup of water in a minute using a similar frequency to a phone. A phone has nowhere near that power. It can't cook anything, despite those fraudulent things about popcorn. That's not true. It's just a fake on YouTube. But going back to this issue, what the researchers did was the following. Using weak radio frequency energy, otherwise microwave radiation, they took rats and they exposed them to cell phone radiation. And they injected them with a dye in order to see whether there was any effect on the brain. Now, normally, if you take animals and inject them with this same dye into their bloodstream, in their vein, they do not get the dye in the brain because the brain is protected with the blood-brain barrier. Now, toxic chemicals, as you just indicated, can weaken the blood-brain barrier, especially if the exposure to them starts young in life or in utero with endocrine disruptors and other things that we know can damage developing brains and nervous systems. If you add the radio frequency microwave radiation to the animal and inject it with this dye into the vein, the brain turns the color of the dye, which in this case was a yellow fluorescent dye. Now, here's a very interesting story I tell in the book, Disconnect. The industry hired researchers to, quote, replicate this study, but they didn't inject the dye in the bloodstream. They injected the dye in the stomach. And then they sacrificed the animal, injected the dye in the stomach, sacrificed the animal less than a half hour later, and did not find any dye in the brain. Well, of course not. It takes much, much longer for when you digest things, whether you're a rodent or a human, for anything to get into your bloodstream. And it won't go from the food tract into the brain. It goes from the blood into the brain. So this is an example of where replications are not replications. And unfortunately, there have been other instances of that as well, as I document in that book, right, which, by the way, is available as a Kindle, and it can be bought. And I recommend people buy the printed version, which has a very attractive young Hispanic man, on the cover, on Amazon.com.
Give your website. I want to make sure we cover the issue of the biological effect of low-intensity electromagnetic radiation on living tissue, on cells, and some of that, but also this larger societal reality of how corporations, business, influence both the science and the attempt to regulate the use of the technology that comes out of science when profit is the issue.
Well, I think we see unfortunate examples of that every day in the news lately, you know, where with it's decisions that are made to save money and put health at risk. Most recently in Flint, Michigan, that was a money-saving decision for a short period of time that ended up costing people their children's future, which is a real tragedy. But my website is www.ehtrust.org, environmentalhealthtrust.org. And we also have a Facebook page. You should like us on that for Environmental Health Trust. And we're looking for people to help us expand our social media presence. We're doing some amazing research now showing for the first time ever how much cell phone radiation gets into the brain of a three-year-old. We started that project about almost 4 years ago with the chairman of the Department of Electrical Engineering at the University of Porto Alegre, the federal university in Brazil. And I remember when I was saying I would like to do the model, which we had to develop with an MRI of a child, etc. He said, why do you want to model, you know, the three-year-old? And I said, you won't believe it. And at that time, people were just starting to give these devices to children. Now you can buy a baby teething rattle case for the iPhone, an iPad teething rattle case. Mm-hmm. It's astonishing to me the way people are using these with children. I gave a lecture not too long ago where a young woman physician came up to me and said, Dr. Davis, how did you change diapers before cell phones? I said, what? I don't understand. She said, well, when I give the baby the phone and they put it in their mouth and they calm down so I can change the diaper. Mm. I said, oh, dear. I said, please, don't do that anymore. I said, you know, even just think about the germs, because a lot of people take their phones into the bathrooms, which means that they're going to become like a little petri dish for everything you put it in the bathroom. But it's just not a good idea. You have such a short period of time when you can talk to your babies, and they learn language by the kinds of silly talk that you do back and forth, mimicking their sounds,
which
as well.
And have to be able to participate in.
Absolutely. And there's actually science now that parents that spend more time on their phones, their children have language delay. So if you must give a device to a young child because you're in a long car trip and they're having a meltdown, put it on airplane mode. You can still have some game or something on it. But in fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that young children under the age of 2 have no screen time. Now, that recommendation is because the developing brain needs calm and quiet, and the electrical stimulation of rapidly changing colors and things can be overwhelming for the young brain.
I was in Syria, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. Young children, 5 years old, 6 years old, just out on the street, quite safe, with cell phones in their hands,
really?
Standing, talking. And I suspect that in many countries, that is the one contemporary technology that's most readily available to families.
Well, look, these technologies have positive roles they can play when used for limited purposes and on airplane mode. If you want to download something to them, you can do that when they're connected to the Wi-Fi or the Internet. And the Wi-Fi connection is generally less powerful than the Internet connection. But it's all a form of microwave radiation. And they can be useful for certain purposes. But the Israeli government now has a National Institute on Non-Ionizing Radiation Safety. Right? And that institute has issued guidelines for exposures and to Wi-Fi for young children, recommending no exposure before age 6, and very limited exposure a few hours a week after age 3. So that, now those are recommendations. Are they being followed?
Not regulations or laws.
They are not regulations. Now, some countries, like Belgium, has passed a law. As of 2014, it is against the law to design or give a cell phone to a child age 7 or younger. It's against the law. And in Taiwan, they have it's apparently a crime to give a phone to a child age 2 or younger. And Korea has a program now to discourage what they have diagnosed as digital dementia, which is an MRI-confirmed lack of development of the parts of the brain involved in empathy and impulse control.
That means a reduction of brain cells?
Well, it means a reduction of circuits involved in capacity of the brain. And think about that as a generational phenomenon. Think about what's going on in Syria, for that matter. If you've got those five-year-olds you saw 6 years ago or so are now young middle teens. They may be, you know, picking up guns and firebombs and being involved in civil lives. War.
Or dealing with the depression that they might have otherwise been able to work through, given the disruption of their life and their society by what's been done to them. This is WZRD Chicago. We're speaking with Dr. Deborah Davis, renowned epidemiologist and research scientist, whose most recent book deals with the effect of low-intensity microwave radiation on the development of cancers and other illnesses in human beings. Specifically vulnerable are children and developing fetuses. Can you go into some of the, if you're comfortable, biological effects? Because people usually think of microwave, as you mentioned earlier, as capable of producing heat and heat producing the damage. But in this case, it's the stimulation of certain cellular structures. And I read that also, or free radicals are produced. That's
right.
Ionizing in effect, if I recall my chemistry. And the blood-brain barrier being
compromised.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, in fact, we have a project with more than 100 physicians, obstetricians, led by the chief of obstetrics and gynecology at Yale University. That's Professor Hugh Taylor, who has an MD and a PhD, and has written more than 400 publications. We have a project called the Baby Safe Project, and that website is www.babysafeproject.org. And that project explains why growing numbers of physicians are advising pregnant women to protect their abdomens from exposure to cell phone radiation or the radiation that would come from an iPad placed over the abdomen as well. And that's because of growing evidence from animals, for the most part, where we have done the following kinds of studies. And I'm describing generically an example of a research design that has been replicated dozens of times, where they take pregnant animals, mice, rabbits, rats, or Drosophila, fruit fly, and they expose them to the level of radiation that you would get from a phone, which, as you pointed out, is not enough to make any change in temperature. So we're not cooking these animals. We're just having them exposed to an operating signal that is simulated by a computer to mimic exactly the signal of a cell phone. And what happens here is that the offspring are carefully studied. The animals that have been exposed prenatally are evaluated after the exposure takes place. And as adults, they're evaluated as well. And of course, a rodent gets to be an adult relatively fast. It takes 3 weeks for babies to be made, and it takes a few months for them to be, quote, relatively adults. They live short lives. When these adults are examined, and Professor Taylor published this result in a peer-reviewed publication called Scientific Reports, produced by the Nature Publication Group, he found that those animals with prenatal exposure had significantly increased signs of hyperactivity or attention deficit activity as measured by a standardized scale of animal activity. And they had more fear. So they were significantly different from animals that had not been exposed. Other researchers in Greece, led by Lucas Margaritis at Adamantia Fragopoulos, reported that animals that were exposed who had learned to run a maze, a water maze, were unable to find their way out of a tank of water after exposure to this radiation, even though they had learned to do it before for a food reward. There seemed to be damage to cognition. Now, indications that there is exactly that damage comes from research done in Turkey by Professor Suleyman Kaplan and Sleyman Dazdak. Each of them, working separately, have produced the following kinds of results. They exposed animals prenatally to cell phone radiation produced by a computer-generated signal, and the offspring were studied very carefully, and they examined the part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is critical to memory and impulse control, among other things. And the animals that were exposed prenatally developed smaller brains with more brain damage. Now, that is a huge and important finding that has been replicated, and that I'm working on that with my colleagues at Hebrew University of Jerusalem, where we are trying to connect the dots and working with pediatricians and others to begin to ask questions routinely when you have a child on the autistic spectrum. Find out what the exposure has been prenatally to cell phone radiation and work with parents to reduce exposures at this point. We're also working with the scientific academic pediatric societies to encourage research to be done. Now, you asked before about the political effects of all of this. And unfortunately, while there is a lot of really interesting basic research, we do not have funding for so many of these matters. We do not have funding to create training for physicians in this field of bioelectromagnetics. We don't have funding for engineers to understand the biological impact of electromagnetic fields. So that's number one. We do not have funding to monitor these children who are being exposed now in schools, as Wi-Fi has becoming ubiquitous in many school districts. And teachers, the common core, there's a lot of concerns about it, but one of the concerns that hasn't been well articulated is this. The common core requires testing be done on computers, standardized testing. Some children don't do well on computers. And the idea that we want children to learn to be digital citizens, but making them do this with Wi-Fi as opposed to wired is a problem. There is no justifiable reason to expose children to wireless radiation. If you want them to learn how to use computers, which is a valid and important thing for the 21st century, they should be wired instead of wireless. And if you go to our website, ehtrust.org, and identify the school's program. We have letters that we've written to the Secretary of Education and to school principals and a whole kit of information that explains why and how schools can reduce the exposure of Wi-Fi and still promote use of digital devices as appropriate.
So if I understand you correctly, you've sort of like Peter Montague with Rachel's Environmental Health Weekly provided people concerned about these scientific and technical issues with data that they can take to the officials and make a cogent case about why the issue should be addressed and changes made, rather than going expressing their concerns and then being dismissed as hysterical parents or what.
Well, indeed. In fact, we recognize that there's a lot of ignorance here on all parties. It's not that there are evil people trying to poison our children. But ask yourself this. The World Health Organization, International Agency for Research in Cancer, has a program to identify agents that are suspect carcinogens, and they do this in order that people can make intelligent decisions to reduce their exposures to these agents and come up with appropriate control policies. Among the things they've identified as possible carcinogens are things like some types of engine exhausts. In the past, agents like jet fuel or certain toxic chemicals used for solvents, and certain pesticides like DDT, and now, of course, the cell phone and Wi-Fi radiation. They've identified it as a possible human carcinogen in 2011. In our schools today, we're exposing children to this possible carcinogen.
Okay, that generally is the focus. But life is far more complex than the presence or not of cancer. And whether or not cancerous cell continues its path to terminate, eventually terminating its host, there are well-developed mechanisms to repair damage that leads to cancer, to check the growth of invading agents. Many of the chemicals that we're exposed to as a result of modern life are known to also impact the process of the body to heal itself, as whether it's endocrine disruptors or conventional toxins. Can you address the sole focus on cancer as the main concern?
Right. I think that cancer is, in fact, the wrong question. And I've written this and in Huffington Post and recently in the Oxford University Press, a blog for them as well. Cancer is the wrong focus, and industry loves to talk about cancer in this instance because it is complicated, it is complex, and there are legitimate areas of uncertainty. But I do believe that cell phone radiation clearly causes brain cancer. But I understand if you look at the majority of studies on that topic, they do not find an increased risk, and the majority of studies include people who use cell phones for, say, 6 years, as well as those who use them for 10 or 20 years. And when you combine them all like that, you don't find a risk. But when you look at those who use phones for the longest, in every single study, where there's a significant number of them, you find a risk. But to back to your question and what we were talking about earlier, reproductive impacts, damage to sperm, damage to pregnancy, damage to the nervous system, those are far more important and more difficult to study and less well studied than cancer. But they're more important because the effects on all of us are greater. Let me give you two examples. A number of studies have been done by fertility clinics. And you would ask, well, why fertility clinics? Fertility clinics all over the world were the first to start to see the following problem. Men would show up who were having difficulty impregnating their wives, and they would be wearing on their hips one or two devices. And the clever doctors figured out that these devices might explain why they were having poor sperm quality and quantity. So the first thing they did was a cross-sectional study of sperm count of men comparing those who had phones on their body to those who did not. And they sure enough found a huge difference. Then they did some experimental studies where they took samples of sperm from healthy men and put them into two different test tubes. One test tube was exposed to a cell phone radiation that did not generate heat from a computer-generated signal of cell phone radiation. The other test tube was not exposed. Now, of course, sperm are going to die. They can't live in a test tube. But the sperm exposed to the cell phone radiation died three times faster and showed three times more damage to their DNA. And that DNA on the sperm plays a critical role in allowing the sperm to swim. And you need a lot of sperm to make a healthy baby.
So there's that issue, although perhaps I'm too cynical. In the system that we find ourselves in, the economic ideological system, that's actually good for business. It's created a new area of transaction where people go to fertility clinics to try and address a problem.
Oh, I'm not as cynical as you. I mean, infertility is a tragic problem for couples who face it.
Oh, of course.
And there are many. Yes, and there are many different causes of it, by the way. Absolutely. Including endocrine-disrupting chemicals and metals and pesticides, which have been identified, and men who are trying to get pregnant need to be aware of the need to keep their exposures in the workplace and home to those things, as well as to cell phones. They need to keep those exposures as low as possible. Recently, in the November issue of Consumer Reports, they recommended that nobody keep a cell phone in their pocket.
My point is that we have yet to regulate adequately or prohibit the presence of those other substances in a manner which prevents people from being exposed to them, in spite of the long history of documentation and independent research as a result of the influence of the corporations that profit from their use in the environment and the effect on the legislative process, the political process, which we look to protect us through government agency.
Well, the government agency here has been asleep at the switch, and unfortunately, it's in some sense I want to defend the FCC. They do not have a single full-time health expert on their staff. They don't.
Yes.
And yet they are in charge of issuing the basis for testing of these devices, and the devices were approved in the 1990s based on the assumption at that time that the only effect to be avoided was heating. And it was an acute effect involving, you know, limited exposure period. That was, in fact, potentially relevant when the main users of phones were military and medical, who used them for 6 minutes at a time. However, that is no longer relevant as you've got billions of users around the world. There are almost 6 billion phones today, and many countries like Australia and the U.S. have more phones than people, and most countries have more phones than toilets. So it's really no longer appropriate that we test phones based on an acute effect of avoiding heating when they are now smartphones. An iPhone, if you go to the iPhone and to your settings, which I'm sure many of your listeners have, if you go to the settings on the iPhone and then you go to General and you open that and you click on About at the top of the screen, and then you go all the way down to something called Legal that most people do not know is there at the bottom, and then you click on RF Exposure, in the phone it tells you to reduce exposure to RF, which is in fact microwave radiation, use a headset or the hands-free device or the speakerphone, and be aware that you must keep the device 10 millimeters, 5 millimeters away from the body. That's in the iPhone. Now, for the BlackBerry and for other devices, it will say 2 centimeters, 2.54 centimeters. And the reason for that is that phones are actually tested in this old system, in a holster. Remember, people used to wear them as a holster?
Sure.
People don't do that anymore. But that's still how they're tested in terms of the assumption of an adult male body with a huge head. And they're tested both at the head and at the body. But as Professor Om Gandhi pointed out almost 20 years ago, phones are not tested in the pocket where most people keep them.
Or tucked into their belt or their bra or some piece of clothing if they want to have their hands free. In their... This is WZRD Chicago. We're talking to renowned epidemiologist Devra Davis about the issue of cell phone radiation, microwave radiation, its effect on human health, effect on brain cancer development, now showing up in children, the high likelihood of linkages to cancer and other illnesses that generally are not talked about. Your website, which I encourage people to look at, is very comprehensive, not only on this subject, but on a number of other toxins that are affecting the environment that we're dependent on to maintain our existence as living organisms. And I would encourage people to send questions, if they have, to her website, because they do answer questions. And you mentioned that you're developing programs for people to get involved in spreading this information in
yes.
their communities if they have mm-hmm. concerns or they feel moved to mm-hmm. prevent damage to other people if they haven't lost their empathy yet, which is, I think, a
right.
function of capitalism, actually. But
well, it's complicated. It really is. You know, this technology has revolutionized our ability to respond to emergencies. It has improved ability to do business in remote areas. But the spread and proliferation of its use by children, you know, you would not give a child a cigar. You would not give a child the keys to the car. Giving young children microwave radiating two-way radios, which is what we're doing nowadays, without any direction about safety, is not a good idea. And in fact, I recently met with the director of the Israeli government National Institute on non-ionizing radiation safety, and she used the term, you know, I think this is a form of child abuse, but parents have no idea that they're doing this. You wouldn't let your child endanger themselves in any other way, and yet you are letting them endanger themselves with the kinds of uses that people are condoning today, largely out of ignorance or out of disbelief that there could be a problem. And, you know, with respect to why we don't have more public accessible information on this, that's why programs like yours that you're doing with this radio station are so important. You are allowing us to have a kind of conversation that is long overdue to get the information out. You are filling a very big vacuum here. The conflict of interest that has characterized research in this field is rampant and, frankly, huge. I hate to use that word. But research does not occur in a vacuum. And when it comes to research in this field, many of the negative studies, not all of them, have been well funded by industry. And funding from the private sector, you know, should be a good thing in theory. But when it comes with strings attached, it really cannot be. A recent article by the Friedmans have shown this and documented it, entitled Financial Conflicts of Interest and Study Results in Environmental and Occupational Health Research by Lee and Michael Friedman. And they've gone through and shown that where there is industry funding, this has had a major impact on results, particularly when it comes to discussions like the one we're having today on cell phone safety. Now, the good news is there are some technological fixes, and some companies are moving to make those fixes take place. And I heard rumors that the new iPhone is going to have reduced exposure. Long overdue, but if it's true, it will be welcome. The Samsung phone reports about a tenth the radiation of iPhones. Now, why is that? And if that's true, and it seems to be, then it would suggest that if we simply changed our standards, we would be benefiting people. So this is an iterative process, and what we're doing by this discussion now and what our website, EH Trust, is doing is educating people, informing them, hopefully motivating them, so they'll understand that there are things you can do, and among the things you can do is use a headset, use a speakerphone, turn your phone off when you don't want to be interrupted. Reclaim your life. It's okay to do that. People will be annoyed at first, as my daughter was when I turned my phone off. She said, Mom, I've been trying to reach you for 2 hours. Well, where were you? I said, I was in a yoga class, and I really didn't think I needed my phone on. Oh. And she started to learn that if the phone was off and she was trying to reach me, there was something going on, and I wasn't dead. Because part of what we've done is we've created this sense of urgency, and we're all in a crisis, and at any moment, something horrible could happen. And while it certainly is true in Israel that they face that kind of situation, and they want to have the capacity to be able to connect with one another, aside from those countries that are in a state of conflict and war, we don't have to live like that. We can go back to a time when we can reclaim some of our private time and not be so easily interrupted.
Have you had success on corporate media in finding enough airtime to give your message and encourage people to start to think about what's happening around them? Because a lot of the chronic illness, that's generally sort of dismissed, and they don't really think about how the things they're coming in contact with may be affecting that state of being.
I think that you make a very good point. You know, in terms, let me just set the context here. For more than 20 years, the companies that write insurance for big companies, secondary insurers like Lloyd's of London and Swiss Re, have refused to cover damages from electromagnetic fields. They view this as damages from electromagnetic fields as one of the important unrecognized health threats that they do not cover, because they believe that it can
it's open-ended liability.
Result in huge costs.
Yeah.
And a huge liability comparable to what asbestos did to them. So some parts of the corporate world, the insurance industry, understand the risk. Now, in Japan, they have developed a program called Shinrin-Yoku, otherwise known as forest bathing, or time spent in green spaces. And they have actually studied what happens to the brain when it's exposed to the natural environment. And it's not just fresh air, but it's they use the word forest bathing is a translation, that being in the natural world has a tranquilizing effect on the mind, a restful effect to be in areas of natural beauty. That's why I'm really pleased that Environmental Health Trust is based in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, one of the most beautiful places in the world, where much of the land cannot be developed because it's been set aside as part of the national parks and public lands. And these and some pristine forests and some old growth is still there. And that environment can be restorative. There's no question about it. Now, companies are recognizing this. And as I said, Japan started this recognition way back in the 1980s, and by now they've collected data showing the physiological response, the rest in terms of measures of stress of being in this kind of a natural environment as opposed to a synthetic one. So there's no question about that. Businesses are starting to open up to this, and I know that within Google, there are those involved in laying fiber cable to who understand that this issue is not going to go away, and what is needed is a revolution in hardware and software. Now, I'm confident it will happen, but again, that's why our discussion is so important. It's only when the public gets more engaged in this, it's only when there's better information out there about what we are doing to ourselves now and how we can reclaim and restore ourselves, that we will make progress in seeing this. I think that we need what I sometimes have called a girlcott. A boycott means no. A girlcott means yes. We want to buy products that are safer. We want to refuse to buy products that are harmful. And I think that there's a growing recognition, particularly for young parents, you've got such a short period of time to influence your children. Don't give it away to the tablet. Spend time doing things with them while they care about what you think, while you can still control them, because those years go really fast. They really do.
This is WZRD Chicago. We're speaking with Dr. Devra Davis, a renowned epidemiologist whose research into pollution in the environment is far-ranging. She's written three books about air pollution, about the cover-up of the research, long-existing research, on the connection between tobacco and lung cancer, as well as other corporate crimes. To me, there are crimes when General Motors suppresses information about lead, exhaust, and other components of its business by establishing a cancer institute that pretends to do the studies so that they can report back to the public that the research is still out. That's Sloan Kettering. Perhaps it's long cleaned up its act. I hope so. But originally, it was done as a public relations ploy to mislead people who were starting to raise such questions. What I wanted to ask you about is the role of women in the sciences and their willingness to speak out and take on these powerful economic forces and even present their protest to the damage being done in a way that might affect a positive change instead of an adversarial battle that drags.
Well, I'm glad you. Right. In fact, there are positive changes. Last year, Environmental Health Trust led a briefing of the Massachusetts State Legislature where we discussed with concerned legislatures the kinds of activities that can be undertaken in schools. We met with superintendents and teachers in a number of schools in Massachusetts, and the Ashland school system, led by Cecilia Doucette and other concerned parents, have implemented policies to move from to reduce wireless, to use wired, and that policy to go to wired in wherever possible is now taking root in many schools around the world, in the United States as well, and information on that can be found on our website as well. We are looking for partners in school districts who understand this, and we recognize that children need digital learning, but they need it in doses. They don't go from all to nothing. And nothing to all. And that's where we are right now. There are some schools that's the mistaken notion that we just need to give every child an iPad and they'll learn everything. And those schools that have tried that, including the Los Angeles School District, it's bombed for a number of different reasons that we don't have time to go into now. But as we wrap up, let me just say, those who want information on what we can do, please look at our website, ehtrust.org. Please let us know if we have volunteers out there that can help us, particularly with social media, because we want to get these new packages that we're developing all the time out there more. There's new information coming online on our website about what can be done and what we need to do now to work with citizens, to work with parents and teachers, to come up with constructive solutions, to reclaim our private time, to reclaim family time, and to use these devices in a constructive manner. There's no question they're valuable, but they really have become all-engulfing where there is no way to claim more private time and space. And that's something that lots of people around the world are concerned about, and we know that there's reasons to do it for biological purposes and, frankly, for spiritual and cultural purposes. And I think that WZRD has done a great job here in highlighting this issue, and I am hoping that you're going to get some response from your listeners, that we have a tape recording of this interview that we can then make available as a podcast. We may even be able to transcribe it, and I should have asked about that at the outset. But for your listeners who would like more information, please look at our website, environmentalhealthtrust.org, ehtrust.org.
Thank you so much for extending your time with us, Dr. Davis, and hope to speak to you again. And that's Environmental Health Trust and
ehtrust.org.
Thank you so much. This is WZRD Chicago from nature.rx.
Do you find yourself longing for the apocalypse? I did. I was looking for a reason to live. Hi. Are you feeling tired, irritable, stressed out? Well, you might consider nature.
From the people that brought you Getting Outside comes prescription-strength Nature, a non-harmful medication shown to relieve the crippling symptoms of modern life.
Nature's recommended for humans of all ages, and it's great for pets, too.
Nature can reduce cynicism, meaninglessness, anal retentiveness, and murderous rage. In clinical studies, nature is proven to decrease work-induced catatonia.
Caution. Nature may cause you to slow down, quit your job, or seriously consider what the f*** you're doing with your life.
If you are overly cynical, jaded, or emotionally numb, you may need to increase your dose of nature. Do you have trouble being even mildly uncomfortable? Nature may not be right for you. Side effects may include spontaneous euphoria, taking yourself less seriously, and being in a good mood for no apparent reason.
So ask your doctor if nature is right for you.
This is WZRD Chicago.